And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
Well, I don't know whether you've read about or heard about the latest brouhaha with one of Dave Ramsey's famous comments about what he believes versus what people like us and like the folks at Morningstar, the people who are registered investment advisors, and those who are teaching what we consider to be appropriate kinds of investment decisions that will be in the best interest of the people who are either doing it with the help of others or doing it on their own. But the latest thing that has happened that has caused a storm. Now, again, it's a small storm because not everybody cares, but Dave Ramsey knows how to stir it up. And Dave Ramsey recently came out with a comment on his show about what is an appropriate distribution rate. I know that many of you have read that a 4% distribution rate is appropriate, and that if you take more, you run into the risk of some probability, let's say, of outliving your money. Anyhow, the bottom line is that Dave Ramsey claims that he is comfortable with taking out an 8% distribution rate for retirees, and that sees the rest of us as a bunch of, I think they used the word morons. But let's start, let's go back and understand his position. I think, by the way, I know why all of this is happening. And after I tell you the rest of the story, I'll give you my story and you see if it makes any sense. So it starts with Dave Ramsey's comments about the long-term return of the stock market and what people should expect over the long term. And he claims that the average return for the stock market is 12%. And he's right. The average return for the stock market is about 12%. In fact, there are other parts of the market where that average return has even been much higher than 12%. But you do not retire on the average return. You retire on the compounded, annualized return. And let me just give you an example of how different those two numbers can be. If you start with $100 and you make 50% the first year, you end the year with $150. If then you lose 50% the second year, you end up with $75. The average return is 0 plus 50 plus minus 50 is 0. So the average return is legitimately 0, but the compound return is a negative about 12%. And so when you look at the compound rate of return of the S&P 500, it's closer to 10. And by the way, over long periods of time, as you know, the difference between a 10% compound rate of return and 12 is huge. But you see, if he can promise 12%, and we say you are likely, as a matter of fact, what we tell people is that the worst 40-year period in the stock market since 1926 has been 8.9%. That's looking at a replica of the S&P 500. And the best 40 years was a compound rate of 12.5%. And the average since 1928 for all 40-year periods is an 11% compound rate of return. Now, I know it sounds silly, But if you're talking to people who aren't very knowledgeable about investing, it would be easy to believe that when they heard the word average and they heard the number 12, that it sounds like they should be, that's something they should be able to get or to expect. Now, that's one part of the base. So Dave Ramsey knows how to make more money than Paul Merriman does, and that's the way he presents it. Now, by the way, I have no idea for sure what's in Dave Ramsey's mind, but this is how I feel it is working. And then it goes further. As I understand it, he recommends that people stay invested in an all-equity portfolio in retirement. Now, all of a sudden, if you can get a 12% compound rate of return, there's a couple things that could happen. You wouldn't have to have saved as much money in order to retire if you made 12% instead of 10, or let's say for the sake of discussion here that you're not comfortable with an all-equity portfolio and you're more comfortable with a combination of stocks and bonds that might make, let's say, 8% instead of making 10 or 12%. That means, in theory, if you have some numbers that you need in order to retire, then it means you need to keep working and saving for a longer period of time. Now, there is one thing that I believe. I truly believe that Dave Ramsey would like to have you invest your money following his ideas through his approved list of advisors. Because the sooner he can get you out of that 401k that you're in and get you moved over into an account at one of these advisors that I have heard pay him somewhere between $400 and $1,000 a month to be a member of the list that he will recommend. And I would think when people believe the things that Dave Ramsey says, like you get a 12% return, or that you can take out 8% a year to live on, he's comfortable with that. When they're following him and they see him as the expert, it wouldn't surprise me that the next thing that they would do is when Dave Ramsey says it's okay to put your money into a loaded fund, and I have a list of people here who might sell you a loaded fund, it all seems to make more sense to me. How could somebody as smart, because Dave Ramsey is one smart cookie. There isn't one thing that I know about investing that Dave Ramsey doesn't know. I do believe that. And I believe he would know who John Bogle was and what he did. He would know who Gene Fama is and Kenneth French, because he's been around the industry and he's been committed to understanding this process. But there's one process that is, let's say, in the best interest of the do-it-yourself person. That might be, for example, a no-load mutual fund. It might be a more conservative stance that would have you taking out 4% instead of 8, or having maybe only half your money in equities instead of all your money in equities. But I do know this. If, in fact, you can be convinced when you have $500,000 saved that you can take out 8% a year, there's the $40,000 that you wanted to retire on, plus Social Security and other sources of income. And so that means I can retire. I can cash out of my 401k. I don't mean cash out. I can do a rollover into an IRA. And I can also use one of Dave Ramsey's specialists, his experts, the people that are, I understand, paying him so that they are on his approved list. And supposedly, and I have no way to know one way or the other, that Dave Ramsey's people spend a lot of time and money checking those folks out to make sure that they're people qualified to help you. But it is strange to me, truly strange. And I, if I'm wrong on this one, you please let me know. I can understand if Dave Ramsey had a group of people who followed him that believed it was okay to pay somebody a load. After all it does is probably reduce your compound rate of return by 0.5% a year for the rest of your life. That is in essence the outcome of paying that load. So if I am going to be really doing the best I know for people, there are the people who believe in a load fund. Let us have people who will help people buy load funds. There are people who believe in only no load funds. So we should have people who are there so that when people are trying to decide which of these advisors that Dave Ramsey recommends should I go to. Should I go to the one that specializes in no-load funds or the one that specializes in load funds? Should I be in an all-equity portfolio? I mean, it's one thing to say for Dave Ramsey to casually say you should be 100% in equities, and I can tell you from having been around the business since the 1960s that there are very few people in retirement who are willing to lose half of their money. Because when you're in the stock market, that's part of the process. But Peter Lynch and Warren Buffett have both been quoted as saying, if you're not willing to lose half of your money, you shouldn't have it in the stock market. And so it seems to me there should be a group of investors who are investment experts who are really more conservative and don't believe that you should have your money in a loaded fund. Because they believe they'll be able to help you better in no-load index funds. So there's another one. It isn't that Dave Ramsey says that index funds are bad, but he says that you can do as well or better with actively managed funds. Now, that doesn't mean that a few won't do better. A few will. Over 20 years, the studies show about 1 in 20 or 1 in 10 of the actively managed funds are able to do as well as the index itself. But the index funds have very low expenses, and the actively managed funds have very high expenses. I mean, maybe this is part of the way that they're able to pay Dave Ramsey a fee, is because they're getting compensated in different ways that are in fact making it possible for them to have Dave Ramsey recommend them, even though it may not be the best thing for the investor. But I think Dave Ramsey would have a third group of advisors because he cares. I mean, at some level, I'm sure he cares. I don't know if it's because he's a religious man that I think he cares, or whether I just feel other than, I mean, they say he's got a huge ego. I don't know anything about his ego. But I still believe that if he sat down with somebody and gave them personal advice, he would want to give advice that was going to be in the best interest of that individual. The difference is when you're doing this from afar and you don't really have any personal responsibility other than being the teacher, because I understand just being a teacher. So let me just go back and reflect on this for a second. So if people will cash in their profit sharing 401k plan, move it to an IRA, move that money to one of the advisors that Dave Ramsey recommends, That means that in a sense, they kind of indirectly become a client of Dave Ramsey's. And all that has to happen to make it all work out beautifully is for the market over the next 30 years, let's say, makes enough to support an 8% distribution rate. Of course, plus you got to have an adjustment for inflation. Now, that's particularly important for people who haven't oversaved. Now, my wife and I have oversaved. And by the way, I'd be willing to bet from what I've read online, I do not know how accurate online information is. I know that I once looked up how much I'm supposed to be worth. And I know what my liquid net worth is, and they don't know what it is. It's higher than what they say by a considerable amount. So when I see on the internet that Dave Ramsey is worth about $200 million, I don't know if he's worth $200 million or $500 million, but I believe without feeling like I'm off course, that he's worth a lot of money. And let me tell you about people who have oversaved however they got there. They can afford to take out more. I mean, he may be comfortable taking out 8%. Let's say that he's worth $200 million. And he could then take money out of that 200 just for the sake of looking at the numbers. That would suggest 8% of 200 million. That, what is that? That's $16 million. Now, I'm going to guess his cost of living is not $16 million. I'm going to guess his cost of living, he probably could get by on less than $800,000. So my wife and I, we take out 5%. We take out 5% of the money we have set aside for the purposes of taking care of our retirement. But we don't need that whole five. If the market goes south, we could easily take out less. If the market crashed, we could easily take out less and our life would be blessed. We would still have enough money. And so it's one thing for me to say take out 5%, or for Dave Ramsey to take out 8%, if you got way more money than you need. But when you are in essence retiring as soon as you possibly can, and then you're taking out 8%, which means that if by chance you happen to invest right before one of those big bear markets, remember, he's also advocating you be all in equities. And I've got to encourage you. I've got to encourage you to read the article that just came out this week. It is by Amy Arnott. The good news on safe withdrawal rates. Now, by the way, they've done a study at Morningstar. Now, those are people. I give them high marks. As a matter of fact, in our list of truth tellers, you will see John Reckenthaler and Christine Benz are people that we trust. They don't pay us anything to say that we trust them, but we do. And so they just came out with a study, The State of Retirement Income 2023. And the good news is they are showing you what people should likely be able to take out over the next 30 years, 20 years, 15 years. There are some great tables there, but I couldn't find 8. I couldn't find 7. I couldn't find 6, nor could I find 5 anywhere on that table. And if you've got the time, another one of our truth tellers, Rob Berger, has done a very fine piece on the 8% distribution and Dave Ramsey. Again, not so much attacking Dave, and I don't mean to attack Dave. I mean to attack the advice. And however he makes a living, you know, that's up to him. But the bottom line is this. I think it's bad to get people's expectations out of the norm. Because if you expect the market to do more than it's likely to do for you, you are going to be the type of investor who, when the market is very, very, very good, it's all going to make sense. In fact, it will look like even taking out more than 8% might be a possibility. But the reality is, the point at which the market looks the safest is typically, historically, the point at which you're probably at highest risk in terms of expectations. So I don't agree with the 12% return as the way to base your long-term expectations. In fact, what I have said for decades is take the tables that represent the past as we know them and take 2% off the top. So rather than expecting the market to produce a 10% compound rate of return, build your study on 8. And if you're a 50-50 strategy or 60-40 or 70-30 stocks and bonds, you adjust those returns by 2% lower and see how they do. I also do not think it is in your best interest to put your money into load funds. And here's what we know. We know that load funds are typically actively managed funds, and we know that actively managed funds, on average, I mean, this is a terrible, terrible piece of information for investors who believe in actively managed funds, and that is the average return of actively managed funds in the same category as a particular index, like the S&P 500 or small cap value, whatever the asset class is, the average return is about 2% less per year. And I've said this before, but that average is made up of some numbers that are higher than that 2% difference and some numbers that are lower, which means not only are you possibly or more than likely going to make less than the index itself, but there's a possibility you might make 3% a year less or 4% a year less. And I also don't believe that all people should be all equities. Now, I'm sure that if you asked Dave that question, do you believe all investors should have all of their money in equities, he would probably say, no, but for the ones who are comfortable with all equities, that's what they should be doing. Well, remember one of the biases, one of the biggest, most costly biases of the individual investor. Remember what they say, the biggest challenge we have as an investor is the face that we look at in the mirror in the morning, ourselves. And one of the things that gets us in trouble in life is we're overconfident. We're overconfident in what we know. We think we know more than we actually know. We have feelings, and our feelings are probably very overconfident, but those feelings get interpreted as something that we actually know, and it probably ain't so. Anyhow, I'll have links to both the article by Amy and the study of the state of the retirement income 2023, and a link to the piece that Rob Berger has done. I am so proud to have those truth tellers there to share what I consider to be the best information. I have just a handful of questions I'm going to address this week. One is about some new target date funds that are out. I mean, they're brand new. But iShares, and I'm reading the email, iShares just came out with a brand new LifePath target date ETF. What are your thoughts regarding these ETFs? How would the taxes work in an individual brokerage? Now, as we know, ETFs are more tax efficient than regular mutual funds. And so it is likely that they will be more tax efficient than similar funds that are managed at Vanguard and Fidelity and others. Now, that may not be true. It may be that at Vanguard and others, they'll be virtually the same. But here's what the question from what I know, and that is, do you want to be in an index portfolio that is built on the iShare indexes? And that's an interesting decision. Some months ago, Avantis did a study on the small cap core and small cap value and small cap growth, large cap value and large cap growth. And in each case, there were six different providers of indexes. So there was indexes from Morningstar, from Morgan Stanley, from the CRSP organization, the Center for Security Prices, from Standard & Poor's, and iShares. I may have missed one there. But here's what I know. That when I look at each one of those categories and look at the returns of the average Morningstar, the average Morgan Stanley, the average of each one of these six providers, I can see what the average compound rate of return was over those five different asset classes. And in the case of the S&P, it was 8.7%. In the case of CRSP, it was 8.6%. But in the case of iShares, it was 7.7%. So in theory, if one put together a portfolio of those five different indexes, you would have made, could have made, easily 1% more by being in indexes that are built in a different way than they do at iShares. Now, therein lies the interesting thing. In fact, I think that article at Avantis is available to the public. I'll have a link, and you can read the comments that Avantis has about the difference in how those different indexes are created. They are not all based just on size. There are other factors that are included. Now, I want to look at it in another way. I looked at the 2065 iShare ETF, a target date ETF. It is basically 1% small cap value. It is 3% blend. In other words, about 1% in small growth, 1% in small core, and 1% in small value. It's about 11% in emerging markets, which is mostly large cap blend within emerging markets. And then it's 58% U.S. large cap blend and 27% international large cap blend. So what you ended up with is a portfolio is almost all large cap blend. Now, large cap blend in the emerging markets is the average company is smaller than in the international or the U.S. market, but they are still considered to be the large cap blend in the emerging markets. So how do I feel about that combination? Well, I'm not very excited about it. And of course, as you know, I think, I'm not very excited about the combination that you get at Vanguard. But if I had to pick Vanguard versus the iShares, I would pick Vanguard over the iShares, if for no other reason than there is a very small advantage cost-wise. But to be fair, they're virtually the same cost-wise. So you need to look at the indexes that are being used as far as building the portfolio now. Now, there's a complicated aspect of this, and one of you wrote to me, or you brought this up in a question, maybe at the AAII presentation, and that is that you can go into the information about a mutual fund or an ETF, and it will tell you what they see as their benchmark. Now, you might think that means that they are building their portfolio the way that benchmark is built. For example, the benchmark for Avantis Small Cap Value, and this is in their prospectus, the benchmark is the Russell 2000 Value Index. But their index doesn't look anything like the Russell 2000 Index. It isn't built in any way to be like it. But they see it as the index that they are competing with. And so that is not the same thing as somebody building a portfolio to try to replicate that particular index. And in the case of iShares, you have actual iShare indexes that come out of that organization, which I expect are going to have the same return as the funds will have inside of the target date fund. So no, I would not be a huge fan of this particular target date ETF, but I would be a huge fan of a target date ETF, absolutely. And a third topic here today, and that is responding to an email. A gentleman says, today I listened to my first YouTube Paul Merriman video. Your ultimate buy and hold update for 2023. Very intrigued by your strategy, as I am also a do-it-yourself investor. In that I'm retired and 62 years old and with a wife that will be working for another 3 years, can you direct me towards your more specific information that would be more relevant to my situation? Thank you for sharing your knowledge with the public. It's so needed in our world today. Well, thank you for the kind comment. So if you've been around a while, I think the first step is probably just go on the homepage of paulmerriman.com and go to Bootcamp. And when you go to Bootcamp, you are going to find that the Ultimate Buy and Hold Update video that you saw is one of the first items that we want you to dig into. And we do it through a video and an article and a podcast. And then, of course, we have to have tables to see what the past actually looked like, or as close as we can get to the past. Now, what you get, even if you've been around for a while, what you're being exposed to with that series of pieces is an attempt to show you why we would have these particular 10 equity asset classes in a portfolio. Now, you don't need all 10, but all 10 have been blessed, if we want to call it that, by the academic community as having a high likelihood of creating a premium for the risk that you take investing in those equity asset classes. And the most basic ones of those are large cap blend, large cap value, small cap blend, and small cap value. And blend simply means a combination of growth and value. And we do that both for the U.S. and international, and then we throw in the REITs, and we throw in emerging markets. Well, we don't throw them in. They're included on the list that the academics have said have an expectation to create a premium for the risk. Now, that then says to me that if I want to have equities in my portfolio, at least these are equities I might want to put in. But how to put them together, which takes you to the next layer of information under boot camp. And that has to do with what we call the sound portfolios. There are basically 8 combinations of portfolios, plus small cap value U.S. only, and the S&P 500 by itself. But those 8 are combinations of those 10 that we talked about under the ultimate buy and hold portfolio. So we show you what would the impact, here we go into tables, here we go into measuring risk and return, looking at year by year, as well as decades, as well as the entire period from 1970 through 2022. And when we're into 2024, we will have added the 2023 information. Now, what I know is that there are big differences between these combinations. Some of them performed amazingly well during the 1970 and the 2000 through 2009 period. Others were amazing in the 1990s. And what we want you to see is how different they can be. And as a matter of fact, it wouldn't surprise me if when you looked at those different portfolios, because you've got maybe some IRAs for you, some for your spouse, you've got some taxable accounts, you could put a number of those portfolios to work. But we give you, as best we know, almost all of the risk characteristics that you would want to know. Now, that then addresses how to put those different equity asset classes together. And of course, what we're hoping for is that by combining them, because they don't go up and down together all the time, that you will actually reduce the risk while you increase the return. You'll see the numbers. We make the case. You don't have to believe it. You don't have to believe David, oh God, now I can't even think of his last name. I'm trying to get him out of my mind. And you don't have to believe me, but this is what we have found. Okay, then you go. And if you're 62 years old, it won't surprise me to find out that you've got some fixed income in your portfolio. I want to know how much you should have. And I'm not going to know how much you should have, but we've given you the tables based on those different equity combinations put together with fixed income. So you can look at the combination of, let's say you had an all U.S. equity portfolio, 25% each in large cap blend, large cap value, small cap blend, and small cap value. And that was your equity portfolio. Great. What does it look like? Since 1970, if you had 90% of your money in that equity portfolio and 10% in bonds, well, the risk would go down a little bit and the return would go down a little bit. But how little is it? And as you go across each one of these tables, you look at the 80-20, the 70-30, the 60-40, the 50-50, all the way down to an all-bond portfolio. So it is not to say that the future is going to look like the last 53 years, but we can look at those 53 years and see what we might feel in terms of comfort. My wife and I are 50-50. Now, we don't use the four funds. We happen to use the 10-fund strategy. But you're going to find the four fund looks almost like the 10-fund strategy. I think there's 0.1% difference in the return. But then we take it a little further. And we think, okay, now that we have shown you what equity asset classes you might use and how you combine them and how you combine those combinations of equity asset classes with the fixed income, now you can go to work and start investing money. I said investing, not taking distributions, but putting money in, accumulating wealth over time. So we have tables that show you, going back to 1970, what if you put away $83.33 a month, starting in January of 1970, and each year you increased it by 3%, and you put it in all these different portfolios that I talked about, and we had them combined with fixed income. How did they do? What was the return? How much money did they have at the end of 30 or 40 or 50 or 53 years? Now, you at age 62 are not in the accumulation phase of your life. So you would then go on and look at the distribution tables. And we have two kinds of distribution tables. For those that didn't save a lot more than they needed, and for those who saved a lot more than they needed. Because those people who did not save a lot more than they need typically are forced to use a fixed distribution plus an adjustment for inflation. And we show you, starting out with a 3%, 4%, 5%, and 6%, how you would have done. And boy, are you going to be interested in how little you will have left with some of those combinations. I will tell you, if you took out 3% with any of them, you left your heirs a lot of money. If you took out 6% and lived very long, there's a high probability that you either were not able to keep up with inflation or you went broke. Those lessons are powerful. And what I'm looking for, because I can't come sit down with you one by one, is for the people who have the patience to go through these steps and make these decisions, because whether you make them quickly because somebody said, well, you know, you can make 12% a year if you put all your money in equities, and here's the four U.S. funds you can invest in, and you can take out 8% plus inflation. If you want to believe without looking at the numbers, go right ahead. But I think believing without looking at the numbers to see the evidence is a huge mistake. There is a reason why most of the people that follow our work are people who are from the engineering industry or the math. I mean, they have a math background. They believe in the math, and they learn from the math. There's more to learn about investing based on the math of investing than in just the companies themselves. So the other then is for people who've oversaved. And that's where we have the variable distributions, like my wife and I do. We can get a big raise if the market goes up because we're going to take 5% of what's ever left is left over at the end of the previous year. That's it. We could take more. We don't. We have things we care about that we want to leave money for, and it's not all children. So we want to show you the best evidence. And by the way, the evidence has gotten better and better over the years. Daryl Walls, the systems analyst from retired from Boeing, he has brought us so many new ways to look at the returns, the risk, and the use of money in retirement. And I think he does it all. He's a volunteer, hundreds of hours every year. And then finally, we have a couple of other items that are really the bailiwick of Chris Pedersen, who is another volunteer and our director of research. Daryl is the director of analytics and Chris the director of research. And those are both important jobs in the work that we do because it's all about teaching people as best we can about the research. And by the way, it isn't just our research, it's research of other people as well. But one area is his work in Two Funds for Life. Chris has a free book about Two Funds for Life. He created the idea. I think it's one of the most clever, simplest strategies I've ever seen. And it compares with the best of them. But he has a whole book dedicated to it. I have a half a book that is called We're Talking Millions. And also, Chris is the one who does the work on creating our best-in-class ETFs. Most of you are likely to use ETFs in the future. And what Chris does, he looks at all of the ETFs that are available in the asset classes that have been approved by the academics, and uses a set of what are considered factors: the size, how deeply discounted the value is, the quality of the earnings within the companies as a group, the number of different companies in the portfolio, the expenses inside of the mutual fund or the ETFs. They're all important aspects of the decision. And then Chris puts that list together. And then he not only does he have his best in class, but he also has a list of other ETFs that he thinks are fine, because not everybody has access to all of them. So by the time you get through all of these discussions, and again, we've tried to hit you with the article, with the podcast, with the video, with tables, then you'll likely have some questions. And the questions we cannot answer are personal ones about what you should do. Now, oftentimes we'll do some nudging in the right direction. I mean, I would certainly nudge you as best I can to no-load mutual funds. I would nudge you to index-like or passively managed mutual funds or ETFs. But we cannot give personal advice. We are teachers. And what we hope is, whether you are students at the college level or students where we also teach, or you are students of life and on your own and wanting to be a better do-it-yourself investor, And by the way, if you're not a do-it-yourself investor, but you're not sure that your advisor is working in your best interest, if you're ending up in actively managed, loaded funds as the right place to be, I would question whether you've gotten good professional advice. And if I found out you were taking out 8% a year, I would say, come here for a second. I want to show you some tables. Of the indexes, forget about the less productive, actively managed funds. Let's look at the indexes where it's about as good as it's likely to get. There you go. I've got one more quick item. And that's about market timing. And this is out of Vanguard. Now, as most of you know, I am not anti-timing. I'm just not pro market timing for do-it-yourself investors. I do not trust that they will ever maintain the discipline to give the timing systems the ability to work. But they do make an important point that we shouldn't forget, and that is that if you look in this particular study from 1988 through December of 2022, and you invested in the S&P 500 and you were there for the entire time, that if you didn't have your money in the market and missed the 10 best days, your return would go down to about 8%. And as you continue to miss more and more of the best days, your return, you end up, depending on how many of the best days you want to miss with your market timing, between 2.6% return and 8%. So I think the point is, and by the way, if you're a market timer, you're not going to be an expert at missing only the good times. You're going to miss the bad times as well as a market timer. But you know something? It's way, way more than the best and the worst 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 days. It is what market timing asks you to do. I want you to have a life. I would like someday for you to say, you know, I think I've got what Paul and Chris and Daryl are trying to teach me. I think I got what Rob Berger is trying to teach me and the other truth tellers that I've been following for the years. Boy, you don't want to miss out with Ben Felix's work. Great, he's a great educator. And others on our list. And you decide you're not going to spend all of your time reading about this stuff. Maybe once a year you'll check back and see if any of us have changed. By the way, I'll be dead by the time that happens, probably. But the bottom line is, if you do investing right, you don't need to spend much time on it. You need to learn the basics. Then you need to understand that as hard as you try, and as hard as anyone tries to be in while the market's going up, and out when the market's going down, and to even be right any more than about 50% of the time, which means you're constantly having to watch the market and you're having to make a move and find out it's not productive and make another move and it's not productive, make a third move and it's not productive. And it's really easy at that point to say, show me again the evidence that this works. And here's what we would show you. Some market timing systems work better than others. Some work for decades and then don't work for decades. Well, that's true of buy and hold as well. The S&P 500 in the last 53 years had 20 years that were rotten or not good. One 10-year period you lost about 1% a year, and another 10-year period where you made somewhere between 5 and 6%. But you needed 12, remember? You were counting on the 12%. The Dave Ramsey, I remembered his last name again. So it The problem with market timing is it asks you to stay involved, and it asks you to have all the emotions of watching the market. What a waste of time. And what I will tell you I've learned about market timing is that the return of a 50-50 buy and hold portfolio is about the same as a 70-30 with market timing. 70% equity, 30% fixed income versus 50-50 equity fixed income. So if you want to expose yourself to the risk of a market timing system and a 70-30, and would rather do it on a buy and hold basis, just change your combination to 50-50 and on a buy and hold basis. And I think you'll do just fine. And what does market timing do? Well, what market timing does, if you're willing to put up with all the other bad stuff about it, is, for example, in 1987, I had all of my clients completely out of the market about a month before the market crashed. And it wasn't because I called the crash. It was because the market timing system said to sell. It was that simple. And then somebody asked me, rightly, I mean, it was a good question, can you tell me that if this market falls that much again, that you'll get me out before it happens? I said, I couldn't possibly guarantee you that. In fact, I can almost guarantee that there'll be some markets that won't get out until after a big decline. If you don't remember, October 19th, 1987, the market went down about 22% in one day. So I don't have all the answers. But the best answers that I know are broad diversification, low expenses, and the lowest expenses are not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for the best expenses I can get for different kinds of equity asset classes that I want access to. And to diversify in a way that I am likely to have something that's working. But there's no guarantee that you're not going to have a year where everything goes haywire. You know, people win lotteries. The odds may not be great that that's going to happen or low that's going to happen, but it will happen. You'll have years that no matter how hard you tried, that everything kind of was stacked against you. But it'll be one of many, many years, and most of them, based on the past, have been very, very good for investors. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll share this with somebody who might find it useful. And really, if you see the other side that I'm missing on Dave Ramsey, you know my email, paul@paulmerriman.com. Make the case, other than that he wants people to get that money out of their 401k and into an IRA as soon as possible. You make me the case. What is it that he is trying to do? All right. Thanks again.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.